and gentlemen, and welcome to the greatest show on earth.
What's up, everybody? This is William, back for another episode of World of Wally. Guys, I was telling somebody just the other day that as I get a little older, I realize that I've had a long time to make a bunch of money, and I've gave up on that idea. Yeah, you know, I never remember when I was a young guy, I had this plan I was going to be a millionaire by the time I was like 25 or 26 years old. Well, I scrapped that plan. I figured, nah, I'll let somebody else be a millionaire. But as I get a little older now, and I hate to say it, every morning, most of us wake up and the first thing on our mind is money. So I said, you know what I need to do? I need to have a conversation with somebody on this show that's going to show me how to be maybe better with money or better, acquiring and holding on to money. I said, well, let's see, if you need a coach for, if you're going to play football, you need a football coach. If you're going to need baseball, you're going to need a baseball coach. You've heard the term life coach. Well, I went out looking for a guest that was a money coach, and I actually found one. This gentleman actually comes to us from the United Kingdom, jolly old England. His name is Dennis Harhalakis. I say that three times fast. Dennis Harhalakis. Yeah, I struggled with it throughout the entire conversation we had, too. That's why I just referred to him as Dennis most of the time. But, guys, Dennis has spent over 30 years in financial services before he became a behavioral money coach, because he showed me something in our conversation. It's all about thoughts and actions is how money is actually acquired or lost or whatever. But money coaching integrates the latest research from the fields of neuroscience, behavioral finance, and behavioral and cognitive psychology to give us a comprehensive understanding of money and the mind. Money coaching gives us a unique insight into our patterns and behaviors around money. Guys, if you'll hang in after the break, Dennis and I had a pretty impressive conversation about how mental attitude actually affects monetary gain or loss. It's pretty crazy. So hang in there after the break, guys, for my guest, Dennis Harhalakis. See, screwed it up again. Hang in there.
Hey, guys, your host William here. Quick question. Are you a First and Second Amendment kind of person? Because if you are, our new affiliate partner, Tactical Brotherhood, is your place. If you're looking for ammo, guns, or gear, check out the link in the episode notes and enter code PATRIOT15 at checkout to receive that 15% discount. Also, Tactical Brotherhood, veteran-owned company. Now, back to the episode.
All right, everybody, we're back from the break, and as promised today, my guest, Mr. Dennis Harhalakis. See, Dennis, I tried really hard. I practiced it and I still got it wrong. So how are you doing today, brother?
We can start again if you want.
No, we're good, man. We're good. We're rolling at this point. So okay, how are you today, man?
Indeed. I'm very well indeed. Yourself?
I am fantastic. Dennis, coming to us from the UK today. Dennis, where exactly are you located in the United Kingdom?
So Cambridge is kind of somewhere in the bottom middle.
Yeah, even hillbillies from Mississippi have heard about Cambridge. We know that is a very prestigious area of your country. So, all right, here's what Dennis brings to the table today. And I just informed him of what he actually is. He'd never even thought about this. He is a monetary psychologist. He's going to show our listeners exactly why they have issues with money and the management of money, because they tie it to emotions, correct?
Correct, that's absolutely right. Yeah.
First of all, how does one become a monetary psychologist? Like, give us a little of your backstory.
Sure. So, well, I've been working in banks for most of the last 30 years. But somewhere in about 2016, 2017, I just started struggling with the whole concept of money and money anxiety. And I developed money anxiety myself, and I came across money coaching. And I came across it and it suddenly made sense to me. It suddenly made sense about how I think and feel around money is much more important than the numbers. And we get confused because we think it's just numbers, but it isn't. It's about how we feel about ourselves, how we feel about money, and how we feel about money and ourselves. And I came across a company in the US, in California, called the Money Coaching Institute. And I listened to them, and what they said just made so much sense. So I trained as a money coach. And now I help people understand how they think and behave around money. And when you understand how you think and behave around money, you can make better decisions. It helps you to reduce anxiety and negative emotions. And it helps you to communicate in healthy ways. And those are all pretty good things. So that is kind of, you know, the short story on my money coaching, why I am a money coach, and what it does for me.
I'm going to make a U.S. reference here, but does a factory worker in the northern part of the U.S. and a Silicon Valley entrepreneur in, let's say, the California area, do they think the same way about money? I mean, I know there's stress usually associated with it, but is it truly all about the mindset?
Well, it's about the way to understand how we think and behave around money is to understand how our brains work and then how they got wired around money. So my process of money coaching walks people through that. We get confused very easily because we think that because we can think rationally and consciously, we're having a conscious conversation right now. We think, okay, that's how we behave most of the time, but it isn't. So in fact, our brains were not, we didn't evolve to do financial planning. We didn't evolve to do long-term thinking, none of that. Our brains evolved to keep us alive in an environment of great danger and uncertainty. That is the primary function of the brain. It's not anything to do with long-term thinking. It's not anything to do with money. It's how do I stay alive? How do I stay safe? The brain is very good at keeping you safe. Now, the problem with that is that the concept of safe is based on how we used to live 30, 40,000 years ago. We don't live in that environment anymore. So the brain evolved to keep us safe in an environment of physical uncertainty. But nowadays, we feel unsafe if we have a tweet, or we look at our bank balance, or we get the credit card bill. There are a number of things. There are lots and lots of things in our society that make us feel unsafe. And so the concept of staying safe is really powerful, because the only future that matters is the one that you're alive to see. So staying safe right now is really, really important. That's how your brain is wired. It's wired to keep you alive right now. Not like next week. Next week's no good, because if you don't get to next week, that's no good to you. Right now. So we have this really super powerful staying alive mechanism that keeps us safe, and that's what our brain does. It also regulates the blood and all the other metabolic activities and all of the energy that we need to spend. But, you know, that again is all about being safe. So we have, when we detect danger, we have this super powerful response that gets us out of danger. But if that danger is like, you know, a credit card bill or a tweet or you know, some guy looking at you across a bar or across the street or across the car or just something you perceive, then having that super powerful fight, flight, or freeze response isn't necessarily very helpful. Right, fight, flight, or freeze is not a way to manage your finances, but that's what comes up for all of us. So the first thing to understand is, what does your brain do? How does it work? The second thing is, how does it get wired around money? So how it gets wired around money is based on all of the messages that we got about money and about ourselves and about money and ourselves when we were growing up. So that is really the extended family environment. So if I was to say, William, when you were growing up, what sort of things would the adults say about money? Money doesn't grow on trees.
Money does not grow on trees. I've heard that 1,000 times, yep.
Right. So what does that mean to you? What do you think that actually means?
You know, I don't know. I guess I looked at it a little differently. I was raised in a middle class situation here in America, and we never really wanted for anything. I mean, there was a few. Right. Let me back up. There was quite a few things I wanted, but it wasn't those what I would consider necessary items. And I know my parents, raised me under the same conditioning that they were raised by their parents, because my grandparents was the generation that had to live through the Depression and post-Depression. So they saw what real need and necessity was. I think that's the biggest problem with people today, is they don't actually understand the concept of what real need is. If you really need something, you would be able to position yourself in the best possible way to get those items. If you use good sense and, good common sense and just a little bit of, mental conditioning, because I was going to ask you about that mental. Is it a mental conditioning that you kind of have to do to understand, like, what your money behavior or your behaviors about money are?
Yeah, so we need to tease out a little bit more about your money history. Your money history was... money doesn't grow on trees.
Right.
That can mean a number of things. It could mean you need to work hard to get money.
Right.
You don't get handouts. It could mean that only if you earn money is that good.
Right.
For example, unearned money is bad. Right. So there's a number of different messages that are all tied up in that simple concept of money doesn't grow on trees.
Right.
And so, teasing that out and how that affects your behaviors is your money history. It's your money scripts. It's what goes through your head when you make a financial decision. Is money doesn't grow on trees. So, for example, that could be like if you haven't got the cash, you don't buy it. That could
right,
be one
right.
message. Right. Now, so that's going to inform you around when you look at something and you go, well, I don't have the cash, so I'm not going to buy it. Someone else might look at that and go, well, actually, it's okay to put it on a credit card as long as you can pay it off at the end of the month.
Right.
Somebody might look at that and go, make the same decision and go, yes, I want it now. Right. So all those things, that decision-making process is about how you feel about, how you learned to feel about money and how you learned to feel about yourself. And that comes from your parents' messaging. So you've got a really strong traditional messaging coming from people that lived through the Depression. My father too. My father was born in 1919, so very strong Depression era type
right.
of mentality. Money doesn't grow on trees. I don't have money for shoes. Don't kick stones. We don't have enough money. And it was a very, very kind of you don't want to run out of money, which then left me with a huge amount of money anxiety. But that's what it was like in those days. So the other thing that goes into this whole mix is what is the broader cultural messaging? So 1930s, credit cards didn't exist. Credit cards came in the 1950s, right? What do we get today? We get thousands of messages every single day saying that if you buy this, drive this, wear this, have this, you will be rich, successful, happy, all those things. The underlying context to that, which I find really insidious, is if you don't drive this, wear this, have this, you are not good enough in yourself.
Right.
So it has changed. You can't take that 1930s message and throw it into today and expect it to have the same resonance. Because we are, right now, we are targeted, right, with these things around all of this stuff. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that all of this goes into the mix, because it's not just about money, it's how you feel about yourself. And if you feel... if you suffer from low self-esteem, if you feel and you're always comparing yourself to other people, or you have, there's this thing called social indifference. Social indifference is where you don't worry about what other people wear or tell you and messages for the media. But if you don't have social indifference, you're going to be very worried about that. You're going to look at that and go, I don't feel great about myself today. Maybe I could buy something that's going to make me feel a little better or look a little better, because that's what the messaging is. So it's a really hard, really hard place for teenagers to grow up in, when everything is like bombarding them with messaging, but also they can see what everybody else is driving or wearing or having. So it's not just a question of, you know, when we grew up, it was like, well, what are the guy down the streets driving? You know, what sneakers are they wearing?
Right.
Right. Because now it's everybody and it's in your face and it's 24/7. So it's a very, very challenging environment. And so teasing out for people around their money history and how that translates into how they feel about themselves and how they feel about spending is the process of the core process of money coaching. And then when you bring consciousness to that decision-making process, it allows people to go, oh, right, now I know why I'm trying to do that. It's not great for me. Now I can do it better. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. So, I mean, let's jump into the one question. If I had listeners submit questions, this would be the one question they would have to ask. Why is it so hard to be able to manage your money?
I don't think it's a simple process anyway, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, really. So if you ask, I ask every single one of my clients, did anyone ever show you how to manage money? And the answer is always no. Right? Now, you can say, well, that's why they've come to you, right? Otherwise, they wouldn't be your clients. If they knew how to manage money, they wouldn't be coming to a money coach.
Right.
But also, I think if you ask, so that's true, but if you ask most people, no one ever sat down and showed them. So this is an interesting thing, which is the more emotional you are around money, the less rational your kids will be. The more rational you are around something, the less emotional your kids will be around. So when we go into adulthood and we start managing money, we are dragging all of our parents' fears and guilt and shame with us. And that blocks us from seeing things objectively. So the system is complex. It's got far more complex than it has to before. The world has moved faster. And the kind of safety nets that existed in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, all those great, that great post-war era where lives got better and wages got better, and the American government invested heavily in building wealth for the post-war generation, well, at least most of them, right? So there were pensions and there was a whole set of things that came in, and if you worked hard, you could succeed. It's not that like that anymore, right? Wealth distribution is very, very, very unfair. And so when you struggle with something, you come up with, so if I go back to my clients again, a lot of them come in with exactly that question. They say, and then in their heads, they're going, how do I do this? Why is this so hard? What's wrong with me? When you go to the state of what's wrong with me, then you're essentially, it's a really hard space to be in because you're blocked. You're racked with shame and fear and guilt and regret. So when you were growing up, you know, I'm sure a lot of messages you got were things like, why don't you understand this? What's wrong with you? What did the teachers used to say? This is simple, right? What's wrong with you? Why don't you get this? What's wrong with you? Now, take that messaging and put it into the context of, I can't get my finances to work. It's only numbers. Why can't I do that? You end up in a position where you go, what's wrong with me? Why can't I do this? There's nothing wrong with you. No one showed you how. It's really difficult. And you get blocked by guilt and shame around this. You need a safe space where someone can say to you, don't worry, I'll show you how to do this. Where does that exist in the world? Where do you feel safe talking to someone about money fears without fear of being judged.
That's true, because I mean, it's a lot of folks don't want to talk about any issue they have because the fear of being judged for that. And money has got to be at one of the very top of the list. From what I'm hearing you say, from what you've said so far, is, of course, we need to learn as quickly the process about how to manage money, because we've talked about negative connotations and emotions driving decisions. And so I'm assuming that we need to get this message out as quickly as possible to the youngest people in our household, which would be our children. So what's the best way? Like, what would you suggest to be able to get this message in a clear and concise and understandable way to the children that you have?
Thank you very much for asking that, because that's an area I'm very passionate about. And I will tell you that. What I would just say beforehand to your listeners is, what I'm holding in my hands is a smartphone. This smartphone connects me to all the known information in the world on every single subject. So if people are struggling to manage their finances, and I have compassion for that, it's not because of lack of information, right? It's not because it's not there. It's because they don't feel they can connect themselves to it. My job as a money coach is to show people how to absorb the information that's available to them, to make them feel good about themselves. So I've just got to touch on one thing quickly, because I think it's quite important here. There's a guy who did in the States, he wrote a book called The Millionaire Next Door, and he identified four core things. He interviewed 500 or 600 people who'd all built up wealth over their lifetimes. They weren't given it, they just built it up. They had four things that they all had in common. One is, it's called frugality. They didn't spend all their money. They saved a little bit of money, but they didn't spend all of it. Second thing is that they educated themselves, so they had confidence in what they were doing. Third thing was they took responsibility for their financial futures. They didn't blame someone else, the system, the universe, the government. And the fourth thing was social indifference. Now, all of which we touched on, in other words, I'm not worried about what the messaging. Now, what's interesting about that is all four of them have a really strong emotional subcomponent. It's really hard to look after your finances if you're scared to look at your bank statements. It's really hard to do social indifference if you're worried about what people think of you, and judgment. It's really hard to educate yourself if you don't feel confident in yourself. And it's really hard to feel like I can control my future. When in fact, you know, so much of the messaging is just slightly chaotic around that. So to take this round to answering your question about what we do with young people, I think there's some key things here to do with that before we get to teaching them financial literacy. One is, as adults, we need to model positive behaviors around money. It's the most important thing that you can do for a child, because a child will just absorb everything that it sees and does, sees around it as information. And it takes that information and it creates a model of the world and says, this is how people operate. This is how parents talk to each other. This is how kids talk to each other. This is how kids talk to mums and dads. And this is how dads, you know, talk to kids. And this is what, you know, this is what kids do. This is what boys do with dads. And this is what girls do with moms. All of that stuff comes out of the home environment. So when you look at the home environment, because of the financial distress, most arguments and most distress in the home environment is around money. So what that's messaging to children is, money is conflict, money is anger, money is guilt, money is shouting, money is deceit. And all of those, and then when you've got people going, you know, he spends too much or she spends too much and he doesn't spend enough and you're too tight and you're, you know, have no idea what you're talking about. All of that stuff resonates with kids, and they soak it all up and they take it away. So we have to be the models. We have to behave well around money so so that our children can go, okay, there's nothing scary, there's nothing bad about it. We need to learn how to manage it. And the adults are going to model good behaviors around this. So that's the first thing, because primarily that's where kids will learn everything about how the world works from their parents. The second thing I think that's really important is about chores and work ethic. And there's a lot of opinion on this. It's like, do you pay your kids for grades? Do you pay your kids to do the lawn? What do you pay kids to do, and how do you teach them around a work ethic? So, and how do you not get that confused with money? So I take the view, and all the money coaches I work with take the view, that there are certain things, the jobs that are part of being the family. Taking the dishes away, walking the dog, taking the trash out. These are family chores that operate as being part of the family. We as adults have to model good behavior. So if your wife says to you, or your partner says to you, can you take the trash out? You don't pull a face. You say, sure, I'll take the trash out, or whatever. Because otherwise the kids are going to copy you, right? If you turn your nose up every time your partner asks you to do something, that's what they're going to learn. So we need a model, and we need to show kids how to do a lot of stuff. And we need to make sure that we don't laugh at them when they do it. And we need to make sure we don't undermine them when they do it. Even if they're not doing it very well, they're learning. One of the things that we suffer from is the curse of knowledge. We forgot what it was like to wash a car for the first time. We forgot what it was like to sweep the floor. We forgot what it was like to do all those things. And they're really simple for us, but they're difficult for kids. So if you want your kids to develop a work ethic, you have to model it, and you have to support them during the process. And the third thing is, you need to have reasonable discussions around how you make choices. So if you go into a store and go, what's the biggest TV you've got? I want that one. That's what the kid is going to think is normal behavior. If you want your kids to have conscious, thoughtful processes around buying stuff, that's what you have to model. And again, there's no judgment on this, any of this. It's just, what I try and bring is consciousness to the decision-making process, because our subconscious processes are like wired into fight, flight, or freeze. Our subconscious processes are, how do I feel safe? Not like, how do I make a good long-term decision around this? And so having open discussions around money and modeling to kids that it's okay to talk about money and we're not scared to talk about it is really important. The fifth thing is teaching financial literacy. So the most important tool of teaching financial literacy is to give kids money so they can make their own decisions around spending. And this is where a lot of people stop. It's not the same as chores, right? Chores is building a work ethic. And so what you do is you split chores into things that you need to do to keep the family running, and have bigger jobs that you might pay someone else to do. So these other jobs, they may be like washing the car. I don't know. It's from a family-to-family perspective. But the kids need to do the chores that are part of the family, and then you can pay them for other stuff. So the idea behind giving the money is not giving them the money for nothing. This is not free money. This is money that you would have spent on them that they now get to make choices around. So let's just say candy. I don't know. I've done this for my own kids, and I go, okay, fine, you're going to spend $5 a week on candy. Here's the $5. I'm not buying you candy anymore. That's the way to learn how to make decisions. They'll probably spend it all, and that's okay, because they're kids, right? What do you expect a 7-year-old to do? If he saves some of it, that's great. And if he doesn't, that's okay. It does not turn them into a lifelong spendthrift. Kids do not learn how to make a budget, look after themselves at 17 or 18 if they've never done it before. If you've never given them the chance to practice decision making with real money in real situations, then they weren't going to, giving them a lecture at school isn't going to help. Right? This is because we learn by experience primarily. That is how all of our models of how the world built up is learning by experience, right? How do you teach a kid to ride a bike? You give them a lecture of momentum? No, you stick them on a bike, you push them off, and they learn by experience. And they get that. So you've got to give them some money that you would have spent on them, and you've got to let them make choices, and then you leave them to it. You don't undermine them. You don't go, you what? You spent all of that on that pair of shoes or that dress or that you know, CD or whatever else it is. You can't undermine kids' choices, because then what they do is they go, I don't make good choices. I'm not worthy. Now, try going through life when you don't feel like you're making good choices, when your parents criticized you for every choice that you made in life. That's no good, is it? Okay. So it's really hard. Don't get me wrong, right? It's really hard to do this. It's really hard to look at your kids and go, call that a haircut. But, you know, when we shut conversations down around money, when we criticize them, we undermine them. And this stuff comes up later in life. So those are kind of some of my core things around how you teach kids financial literacy. And then, yeah, so some of it's practical. If they're 17, 18, 19, whatever, going off to, is it high school you call it?
Mm-hmm.
Then, yeah, you know, but if you've started at age 10 or 12, giving them money to spend and money to save, so showing them how to save money. So if you've given them $5, then you say, here's $4 for you to spend and $1 for you to tuck away. So you need to give a mechanism for showing them how to save. And then if they can, then you can do things like, well, if you can save $10, I'll match it, right? So you need to develop mechanisms that reward delayed gratification. If you want your kids to save, you've got to make it worthwhile for them. They don't earn anything, nothing, you're getting nothing from the bank account, right? You put in a piggy bank, you don't earn interest. But you, as a parent, can support that by rewarding them for saving their money.
Okay, that's some real education right there, talking about the mindset that you have to have, the example you have to serve, and then, of course, the children are going to emulate that. Before our time gets away from us, though, I have got to cover this topic with you about money. If I am rich, or if I'm a wealthy individual, I don't have any problems with money, because money is directly associated with happiness. That's a true statement.
Yeah, money. So I think you need to tease this out a little bit. Having money reduces unhappiness.
Oh, okay.
Can we agree on that?
I don't know. You know, if I had $1 million in the bank, I probably wouldn't be as stressed as I am right now. But that's just me, though.
And you're right. Okay, you're absolutely right. So money reduces unhappiness, but above a certain point, it doesn't necessarily buy you happiness.
Right.
So I think most of us are never going to have enough money to really find that out. So but you have, you know, and it's kind of hard to look at people with lots of money going, why aren't you happy?
Yeah.
And that's because money and our relationship with money is not a direct thing. I mean, look at the two richest people in the world who just got divorced.
Right.
So, you know, it's got nothing to do with money, has it? Yeah, no, I really get why it's easy to understand that, and because when people have done research, I think basically what they've concluded is that, you know, somewhere around about $75,000 to $100,000 will bring increasing happiness, but after that, it tails off a little bit, and so what happens there is that people get stuck on this thing called it's called a hedonic treadmill, which is, well, I've got this. And so now I need this. So whatever it is that I get, I'm going to spend trying to keep up with the guy who's got the car next door or the holiday over there and people. And so, you know, it sounds ridiculous. People are struggling on and they go, I'm struggling. I'm on $500,000 a year and I can't get this. I don't feel happy. Now, try to reserve judgment around that. And I think what it's really telling you is, your relationship with money, your relationship with yourself is not great. If that amount of money can't make you happy, then you really need to to understand, you know, that there's you've got to look at what it is. You've got to understand what you like to do, how much money you have to, and why aren't you spending all that money doing the things that make you happy? Because if looking at your phone, scrolling through your Instagram feed and buying stuff on Amazon isn't making you happy, then you really need to come up with a different strategy for life, because that isn't going to change. It's not the next $1 million or the next $500,000 that's going to make you happy. If you're not happy with $1 million, the next million won't do it.
So what you're saying is money and well-being are not synonymous terms?
Above a certain amount, you need enough money to meet your core security needs. You need to be able to feel safe and secure. You need to be able to feed your family. You need to be able to have a minimum number of things that that mean that you're not on the bread line and worrying about where your next meal is coming from, or whether you can buy a pair of shoes, or whether you can put gas in your tank. So all of those situations are stressful situations to live in. But once you get above that, happiness is an internal thing. It's how you feel about yourself. And the biggest predictor of happiness is having good personal relationships. Good personal relationships with your family, with your friends, where you feel loved and where you can love back. That's what long-term studies tell you. And if you think about it from an evolutionary perspective, that makes a huge amount of sense, because we didn't have money 20,000 years ago, so it can't be the key to happiness. Things cannot be the key to happiness, because we've been evolving for thousands and hundreds of thousands of years, and these things never existed beforehand. So they can't suddenly, an iPhone suddenly can't make you happy. I mean, you can derive pleasure and satisfaction from it, don't get me wrong, but it can't, the key to life, the key to happiness cannot be objects like that. It can only be around what's been part of our evolutionary history, which is living in groups where we feel supported, where we feel heard, where we feel understood, where we feel safe.
Okay. So kind of in a summary, I'm going to put you on the spot here at the very end before we share your information on how to reach out to you. Three practical tips that you could give someone to at least get them in the right direction.
Okay. The most important thing is to have compassion for yourself. We didn't make most of the choices that make us who we are, but we can make choices about who we want to be. It starts with self-forgiveness and self-compassion. If you don't believe that you can make good decisions, it's going to be very hard for you to change your life, and you're just going to fall over at the first time. So forgive yourself. You really didn't make most of the choices that got you where you were. You like to think you are, because as a society we go, well, you know, you're responsible for this, and that means we can lock you up. And the religions tell you, oh, you're responsible for this, and so if you don't do this, you know, you're going to go to hell or wherever it is. But in reality, a lot of the way we think, a lot of the decisions we made came out of our childhoods, and you didn't control any of that.
Right.
So start with self-compassion.
Okay.
Second thing is, understand that feeling uncomfortable is not a choice. You don't choose your emotions. You don't choose to be angry. You don't choose to be sad. You don't choose to be regretful. They're messages that are telling you where you're not whole. However, when you don't blame yourself for that, like you don't choose to be those things, but you can look at it and go, okay, what's that telling me about what I need to do? Engage with your discomfort. It's a message. If your leg hurts, it's telling you you've hurt it, or you might need to go to the doctor. It's telling you you need to do something. It's a signal from your body. Discomfort is a signal that's telling you that somebody or something, you need to deal with that. You need to look at that. Don't run away from it. It's okay. When you bring your attention to something with the spirit of curiosity and self-compassion, you can change everything. Get curious around things that challenge you. We all know how to do this. If it's something you really want to do, like you want to learn how to play golf or whatever, it's really hard, right? I mean, you get curious around it, you get motivated around it, you go and do it. So it's really easy to engage with the things that we like doing. If we spend as much time engaging with the things that we didn't like doing, we'd be much better off. what's the third thing? So I think that's kind of, you know, enough. And just go, okay, because that will give you the ability to look at things that you find scary and go, oh, I'm not scared by that anymore. All right, you don't choose your fear, but you can overcome it. You can choose how to move forward. And the best way to do that is to find someone that can help you feel safe when you're doing that. Reach out to family, reach out to people and go, this is really scary for me. Can I talk about it with you?
It truly is mindset and mentality. It's the old expression mind over matter. It is about conditioning. I used the term mental conditioning earlier. So it's like Pavlov's dogs. You know, you have to be conditioned to be able to do this. So.
You need to make yourself vulnerable. You've got to get comfortable with that and go, this is really difficult for me. Can somebody help me? Right. You sit and suffer in shame around your finances, they ain't going to fix themselves. You're not going to feel good about yourself. And it's not going to get better, but you can share with that, make yourself vulnerable, and go, okay, there's no shame in not being able to do something that no one showed you how to do. There's no shame in it at all. And this stuff isn't easy. So that's my message. And that's how I support people, and that's my message around money. Society conspires to tell us, you know, we don't talk about this stuff. So, you know, we've come a long way in teaching our children about, you know, relationships, about sex, how to be safe. So we need to teach them about money too.
That's true. Well, Dennis, I can't thank you enough, brother, taking time out of your busy schedule from across the pond in the UK. Before you get out of here, let my listeners know how, if they're trying to find out more information about what you do and about, you know, specifically what you do, where can they reach out to you? Where can they find you at?
You can find me at www.cambridgemoneycoaching.com. That's cambridgemoneycoaching, all one word, .uk. cambridgemoneycoaching.uk. You can find the stuff I write. And there's a contact form, and I'm always open to helping people with a conversation. And so hopefully if you've listened to me and you like what I've got to say and you've found it useful, that's put you on the first step to finding some financial well-being. And it's been an absolute pleasure. It's so nice to talk to you. Thank you for your great question.
Absolutely. I was glad you and I were able to work this out. We were talking about before I got started, I was going to take a few weeks off from actively interviewing, so I was glad we were able to squeeze you in before the month ended up. I'll be reaching out to you in the future because I definitely want to get an update from you, kind of see where you are and, you know, what you got going on. So, like I said, can't thank you enough, Dennis. And
my pleasure. Thank you, sir.
And
have a great
I guess,
break. And, yeah, let's catch up later.
I guess I'll catch up with you in the future then. And as always, guys, Wally out. Hey guys, quick shout out to Timothy O. Davis of Ridgewood Recording Studios. His studio offers a full line of music production ranging from song demos and singles to fully produced albums. He focuses on excellence at every level of the recording and production process and will work with you for your project specific needs. So remember guys, Timothy O. Davis, reach out to him at timothydavis.org/Ridgewood Studios.
This podcast is part of the SJ Network. Go to s-j-network.com for more great podcasts and for contact information on publicist Steve Joyner.